I'm Sam Zeff, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Courts using monitoring devices to keep track of defendants awaiting trial. In Missouri, those devices are supplied by private companies who charge a fee not everyone can afford. This month, new rules about bond went into effect for Missouri courts, including an option to waive monitoring costs. So why aren't more judges giving the poor a break? We'll ask a member of the Missouri Public Defender's Office the impact this is having. Then, FEMA is providing support to Midwesterners after devastating storms wreaked havoc across the Plain States. We'll talk to a survivor who once benefited from the help of a disaster survivor assistance team and now works with them. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. A lot of criminal justice issues today, and now we'll cover bail in Missouri. On the 1st of July, new rules on bonds took effect in the state. Used to be someone who couldn't pay the fee for being monitored while out on bond could be sent back to jail. Some called it a modern debtor's prison. But now judges can waive that fee for the indigent. However, as we're about to hear, some judges are ignoring this new rule. Joining me is Matthew Mueller with the Missouri Public Defender's Office. Matthew, thanks for being on Up to Date.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
And let's start at the beginning. What was the rule before July 1st, and what's the rule now?
So prior to July 1, there was no Supreme Court rule of criminal procedure addressing the payment of monitoring fees for indigent defendants. There was a comparable rule in state law that permitted, did not require courts to waive the fee for indigent defendants. But as you mentioned, beginning July 1 of this year, just a couple weeks ago, the Supreme Court of Missouri promulgated new rules through the criminal rules of procedure that now authorize courts to consider waiving these fees for indigent defendants. And that's something that our office has tried to push through the courts for our clients who are being ordered to comply with these conditions of release but are unable to pay for the costs associated with those conditions of release.
You argued that case before the Supreme Court, correct?
Yes. Yeah, so the case is currently pending in Clay County Circuit Court in Liberty, Missouri. We are representing an individual who is in jail solely because he is unable to pay for the alcohol monitoring device that has been required as a condition of his release. We argued that issue in the Clay County Court. The judge took the position that the court is unable to waive these fees because it is being provided by a private company based here in Kansas City. So our office sought a remedial relief first in the appellate court and then ultimately in the Supreme Court of Missouri.
You know, I think people would be a little gobsmacked to know that much of this monitoring is done by private companies who are in it to make a profit. That seems inherently bad for people who are going through the system who might be poor. What do you think about that?
I think that's right. There are a number of private companies that have come into existence recently here in Missouri as well that charge enormous fees for various monitoring devices.
How much? I mean, give me an example of an ankle monitor or a breathalyzer that you have to blow into before you can start your car. What does that run somebody?
Sure. So when we argued this issue in court, a representative from this private company called ESA appeared in court and told the judge that the daily fee for this alcohol monitoring device would be $14 a day. So that comes out to roughly $100 a week and, of course, several hundred dollars a month that this individual would be required to pay. And this is money, again, that is not going to the court but is going to a private company. And again, talking about how problematic this is, unlike other creditors who claim that they are owed a certain debt, this private company, because it's utilizing this court order, can ask the court for assistance in collecting that debt, and often does. If our clients fall behind in their scheduled payments, these companies frequently file letters with the court advising the court that our clients are falling behind on these payments. And that could then prompt the court issuing a warrant or a notice for the defendant to come into court and explain why they are falling behind on these payments. And that's the distinction that I think is very important, that this private company can call upon the courts in collecting these debts in a way that ordinary creditors cannot. Say, you know, if you're falling behind on your phone bill or your cable bill, you don't have to worry about those companies, right? AT&T or Charter asking the court to haul you into court or to arrest you for not paying your bills. But in this case, we do see that.
In your arguments before the Missouri Supreme Court, what was the countervailing argument? What was the argument in favor of allowing people to be put in jail who have gone into arrears on monitoring fees or such?
So prosecuting attorney's office, this would be the Clay County Prosecuting Attorney's Office, was asked by the Supreme Court of Missouri to file suggestions in opposition to our petition that we filed in the Supreme Court. And they had a number of arguments, but their ultimate argument was that the court does not have authority to order a private company to provide its services for free. That's the basic argument. And that indeed was the argument that the trial court judge made when we argued this issue before the trial court, that the trial court simply does not have the authority to order this private company to waive its fees. And, you know, the trial court invited us to seek guidance on this issue from the appellate courts, and that's what we're doing currently. But that is the ultimate countervailing argument against our claim that our clients, because they're indigent, should not be required to pay these fees and, you know, should not be jailed because they're unable to pay these fees. And unfortunately, that's what's happening.
Yeah. Matt Mueller from the Missouri Public Defender's Office is my guest today. We're talking bail in Missouri. You know, it's not just monitoring devices that can land you back in the hoosegow. If you don't pay something that they call board fees, that can also land you back in jail. What is a board fee?
Sure. So a board fee is a daily rate that various counties who have jails charge defendants for each day they're in jail. Counties charge what's called a daily board rate. And at the end of the criminal case, which could be several months in length, the court will assess what's called a board fee against the defendant. And to give you guys some idea, these board rates vary between $40 to $60 a day. So if someone is in jail for a couple of months, that fee can quickly exceed several thousand dollars, and in fact does in many cases. And previously, what courts were doing is calling this board fee a court cost. It was part of court costs, which defendants owe at the end of the case. And so it was under that idea that courts were ordering clients, our clients, defendants, to come back to court to address the status of their payments on these board bills. And unfortunately, in some cases, we saw defendants rearrested and reincarcerated for not paying these daily board bills.
So now judges have the option to waive at least some of these monitoring fees following the Supreme Court. Are they doing it?
Well, in Clay County, they are not. This was brought to my attention from attorneys who from, you know, local attorneys in the public defender's office in Clay County in Liberty, Missouri. And as far as I can tell, the court there is not waiving these fees, again, on the idea that they are without authority to order this private company to provide its services for free. So, yeah, to answer your question, unfortunately, courts are not waiving these fees, even though the new rules that went into effect July 1 explicitly authorize and arguably require courts to consider waiving these fees.
Is this happening anywhere else besides Clay County that you've heard?
I have not heard anything yet. I have received some emails from other attorneys across the state. We are in the process of litigating this issue because, again, these rules went into effect July 1. So I'm interested to see how this plays out. But as far as I'm aware, there are no courts which are waiving these fees currently, though I could be mistaken about that. But I'm not aware of any courts that are waiving these fees in response to the new rules that went into effect July 1.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about the long-term effects of this, but I'm wondering, so just as a procedural matter, what are you doing now? Do you go back to the Supreme Court? Do you have to start all over again at the circuit court level? How does this work?
Sure. So the one of the arguments that was made by the Clay County Prosecuting Attorney's Office was that we should go back to the trial court and seek relief because in that particular case, the case had been bound over into circuit court. So that case is now before a different judge, the circuit court judge, in fact, the presiding judge there in Clay County. And so one of the arguments the Prosecuting Attorney's Office made was we should not be seeking relief in the Supreme Court at this time. We should instead go back to the trial court in Clay County and seek relief. And so without providing much explanation, the Supreme Court denied our petition, but without prejudice, meaning that we can at least conceivably renew our claim at another time. And so I think the idea is it may be appropriate to go back in front of this new judge, again, who happens to be the presiding judge, and ask that judge to waive the fees.
But your client remains in jail as we speak this morning.
Yes. So what's interesting about his case is he was released by the associate circuit judge on May 15. So he was ordered released. The judge deemed him appropriate, fit for release, and ordered his release, no cash bond or anything, but conditioned his release on his getting this alcohol monitoring device equipped before he leaves the jail. And that's the rub, right? Because there is a $400 installation fee associated with this particular device. And so,
is this the device? I'm sorry to interrupt, but this is one of those devices that they install in your car and you have to blow into a tube to see if you had been drinking before you could actually turn the ignition. Is that what we're talking about here?
No, that's an ignition interlock device. That's an option that's available to the court. But in this particular case, we're talking about what's called a scram alcohol, a bracelet that goes on your leg. So this is an alcohol monitoring device that monitors the alcohol intake in your body. And this is a quite bulky device that's attached to your ankle. And that's what's been ordered in this case. And that's what's typically ordered in DWI-related cases in Clay County. The courts routinely order defendants to have this device attached to them before they leave jail. And of course, this private company assesses an installation fee in connection with that device, and that's what's causing our clients to be jailed. And so, yes, this particular client is in jail, has been in jail since May 15, solely because he cannot pay that $400 fee, that installation fee. And again, the judge has already released this person. For all practical purposes, he is released, but is continuing to be incarcerated in jail because he cannot pay this fee to this private company.
And the way you would solve this would have that fee waived. I mean, you're not arguing that he shouldn't be monitored. As I understand it, he has a history of this kind of behavior. So you're not arguing that he should skip monitoring, but somehow be let out of jail, be monitored, but not have to shoulder this $400 fee.
Yes, that's correct. I go out of my way to make the point that in some cases, particularly in cases that are alleging a prior history of DWI-related offenses, this condition of release is appropriate, could be appropriate. So we're not challenging the ability of these courts to impose this as a condition of release, not at all. All we're saying is if you're going to impose it as a condition of release for indigent defendants, the rules now require the courts to consider waiving these fees. And the response from the courts, as far as I understand, is the courts are without authority to waive these fees. And so we have this troubling situation, in my view, where these courts are basically basically refusing to enforce these new rules on pretrial release, which went into effect July 1.
It seems to me that if you're constantly having to find money to pay for your board or pay for monitoring, and you're not a highly paid lawyer, CPA, or engineer, that this puts you in some sort of spiral where you're always ending up in court trying to figure out a way to stay out of the pokey. Is that right?
That's right. And then, to give you one example, in Clay County, it is so if someone is ultimately found guilty or pleads guilty and is given a probation term, these courts in Clay County will often make payment of these fees a condition of the defendant's probation. So this debt follows the person for many years after the case has concluded. The presiding judge in Clay County, for example, in a few cases that I've followed, has made payment of these fees a condition of probation. And what that means is it's possible that these people could have their probation revoked and they could be sent to state prison for no other reason other than not paying the debt that they have accumulated for these monitoring devices provided by this private company.
Yeah, I'm wondering, is there something that the General Assembly, that lawmakers in Missouri could do to maybe ease this situation?
Yes. In theory, our legislatures could pass a comparable, similar law providing that these fees be waived. But again, I think the issue would remain that these courts are under the belief that they don't have authority to order a private company to provide its services for free. In my view, I think what needs to happen is these courts need to consider creating some kind of fund that would pay these private companies to the extent that these courts continue ordering this as a condition of release. So perhaps the presiding judge can get together with the county commission and talk about creating some kind of fund that could be used to pay the private company for these fees. But that's something for them to consider. But my worry is that if our lawmakers passed a similar state law rule, we would have the same issue where these judges are saying, I don't think I have the authority to order this private company to provide its services for free.
Is this a rural thing? Is it a suburban thing? Is it an urban thing? Where is this most prevalent?
So we see this issue in Clay County and Platte County. The particular company at issue here is a company called ESA, which has its central offices here in Kansas City. And then they have various sort of satellite offices in Independence, Raymore, Blue Springs. So in several sort of suburban counties around Kansas City, we see this as an issue. And you also see this as an issue in counties around and inside St. Louis City. On July 3, 2019, there was a great article that came out from the New York Times. The article was titled Digital Jail, and that article described the same exact issue that is occurring in St. Louis City. So we do see this in urban jurisdictions as well as suburban jurisdictions surrounding these more urban cities.
This brings to, you mentioned St. Louis County, brings to light what we discovered after Ferguson, and that is how many municipalities funded their local governments through fines. Is this totally different, or is it part of the same family, what we're talking about now?
Yeah, this is part of that same theme where courts are using the criminal justice system as a way to generate revenue. Now, in this particular example, the revenue that's generated is going to a private company, but that private company is able to exist in the way that it does because it's able to call upon the courts for assistance in collecting its debt. But yeah, this is part of that same theme that we saw in Ferguson, and that's a point that is nicely illustrated in that New York Times article I just mentioned.
I want to go to the phones and talk to Frank in Lawrence, Kansas. Frank, you're on Up to Date.
Thanks. How can you determine if somebody is really indigent as opposed to somebody who has the money to pay but doesn't want to? How is that adjudicated? I'll take the air off the air.
Oh, excellent question.
That is an excellent question. a number of responses. The term indigency has a certain meaning under the law, in my view, and basically that's a determination that is made by the public defender's office. So when someone is charged with a crime and is processed through the criminal justice system, an indigency determination is made by the public defender's office, and in this case, our office has made an indigency determination with regard to this particular client. Now, the courts and the prosecuting attorney's office can challenge that indigency determination. That has not been done in this case. And I would also make the point that in this particular case, we can infer that this particular individual is indigent because the only reason he's in jail is because he can't pay these fees. The situation would be a little different if the person was released, say. So say he paid the installation fee and is released, but is now quarreling over these weekly fees and is claiming, I can't afford these fees. Then a more sort of intensive fact inquiry comes up where, does this person really have an inability to pay? Are they really indigent? But in this particular case, the person is in jail solely because he cannot afford this installation fee. And so I think it's self-evident that in this case, the person is indigent for all purposes because he remains in jail on account of his being unable to pay this fee. But that is a good question. But again, I think ultimately the indigency determination is a determination that's made by the public defender's office, but is always subject to challenge by the courts or the prosecuting attorney's office. That is not something that we routinely see.
Matt Mueller with the Missouri Public Defender's Office, a thorny issue. Thank you for being on Up to Date to get us up to date on what's going on with it.
Thank you very much.
Just ahead, this month FEMA came to Missouri's flood-affected areas. We'll find out how the agency is helping residents get back on their feet. I'm Sam Zeff. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Sam Zeff. Kraske's out, but he'll be back next week. You can find previous episodes of our program at kcur.org/up-to-date. That includes yesterday's conversation with Jackson County neighborhood leaders reacting to the ongoing reassessment mess in Jackson County. Tomorrow, we'll step aside and be following NPR's live coverage of the Robert Mueller testimony. That starts at 7:30. Holy Rosemary Woods, you're not going to want to miss that. And Up to Date, we'll be back on Thursday. We'll meet a hyper-local news publisher who's been covering Kansas City Northeast neighborhood for some 21 years. So it might be a little hard to remember, especially today when it's gorgeous outside, but just a few weeks ago, we were pummeled by storms and menaced by floods. My next two guests certainly haven't forgotten because their job is to help people recover from losses. Debbie Archner is part of a FEMA disaster survivor assistance team, and how she ended up with FEMA is a pretty good story in itself, and we'll go to that in a minute. Debbie, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you so much.
Also with me, Christiana Sanford with FEMA's Public Affairs Office. Christiana, nice to see you.
Thanks for having us.
I want to start with you and ask what FEMA is doing right now in the 20 counties in Missouri and those counties in Kansas that were declared disaster areas. What are you up to now?
Yeah, so, you know, it's been a really long spring so far for our few states. And in Kansas, that was declared on June 20th, public assistance only, and which means that we are focused on those roads, bridges, and infrastructures that were damaged in those storms. So we're working with the locals and the state to move forward with that. And in Missouri, we've had a lot of counties affected for individual assistance, which means we have our disaster survivor assistance teams out going door to door, getting information out to those individuals affected. So we're in communities and neighborhoods trying to get people registered for FEMA assistance, and they can do that online, disasterassistance.gov, or call 1-800-621-3362 to get the help that they need on this road to recovery.
We're going to post those contact informations on our website, but I'm going to come back to you later and have you say them again.
Sure.
Debbie, tell me about your job. What is it that you do day to day when you get in the car and go to work?
Day to day, the disaster survivor assistance teams, we meet first thing in the morning. We lay out take the lay of the land, lay out where we're going to go for the day. And we, in the area that we're in, we visit every door door-to-door in the affected areas. We find that the emergency manager is a wealth of information for us to help guide us to those areas, make sure we're in the right spots.
The local emergency manager.
Yes.
And so you're out with local officials, too, going door-to-door?
No, we're not out with local officials. We meet with them prior to, and they usually provide us with maps and areas of the most affected. And we follow those guidelines from them, and then we spread out as teams.
How long have you been in this area?
In this area, we started the 9th of July.
Wow. How many doors do you think you knocked on?
I think to date we've knocked on 550.
Wow. So tell me a little bit more about the canvassing. You knock on the door and then you say, "I'm from the government. I'm here to help."
No, not quite. We knock on the door and the first thing we ask is were they affected in any way by the disaster? And then we tell them that we're from FEMA, and we if they say that they're affected, then we register them. If they're already registered for FEMA, then we have the ability to do an update on their file or an inquiry for them and tell them where the status is.
Christiana, so what can FEMA offer these folks who've been affected by the storm?
Yeah, we have a lot of great resources. You know, we can get them registered with FEMA, which can cover temporary rental assistance. The first question we ask them is if they have somewhere safe, secure, and sanitary to stay, because we believe everyone deserves that. So we really want to get them set up with that. We can also do small home repairs to get their house updated so they can stay there if possible. And then we can also cover things such as other needs assistance, which can cover medication if they lost that and the damages, or if they require a wheelchair and that got damaged. So we can help replace those immediate needs so they can, you know, get that leg up on the road to recovery.
When you say minor repairs, you can put them in contact with a contractor, and FEMA would pay that bill.
Yes, so
you're
we,
not actually
we
out
can provide
there.
Grants, yes, right. Dollars to get them those repairs.
How much?
It just depends. We take it all on a case-by-case basis, but the payouts can range anywhere from a couple $100s to a couple $1,000s.
Well, replacing roofs.
Yeah, drywall, any of those small home repairs.
Debbie, you have, as I understand it, some firsthand knowledge about just how important FEMA can be after a flood. Tell me that story.
In 2008, my home flooded, and I had no idea who FEMA was, anything about FEMA. All I know is that one day I had a couple of people knock at my front door and said, "We're here to find out if you're okay." And I will never forget that. And they gave me some guidance as to where I could go to a disaster recovery center. They encouraged me to apply for FEMA assistance. And I was able to get some help that I knew nothing about.
Yeah. Where was his home?
Orlando, Florida.
So, and this was after?
Tropical Storm Fay.
And there you are. And so tell me about the damage to your home. What was it that FEMA was able to do to assist you?
Well, the major damage to my home was that it was inaccessible, and I couldn't get to it. And so I had friends bringing me food and in little canoes, and because I was not aware that there was assistance to help me pay for a temporary place to stay until I met these people from FEMA that were out in the field. And so I was able to get some assistance to be able to rent another place until the water went down and I could assess my home and we could get the damages fixed so I could move back in.
Yeah. So you're in your home. It's been damaged by a tropical storm. And the first people to knock on your door wasn't local folks. It wasn't the sheriff. It wasn't the Red Cross. It was an agency that, until then, you know, you didn't know what FEMA did.
I had no idea. And when that happened to me, it really impacted me. And after that point, I thought, you know, I want to do this. I know how good it made me feel. And so that's when I started working for FEMA.
Yeah. And I understand that you were deployed for Hurricane Sandy in 2012. $65 billion in damage in the U.S., billions more in other countries. It has to be awful every day going door to door to see people in such circumstances and in such pain. How do you get past that?
Well, yeah, I guess you could say it's awful in seeing what's happened. But once you realize that when you knock on their door, that you may be able to make their life a little easier, it's all worth it. It's all worth it then.
Tell me a little bit more about how what you're doing around here has compared to other disasters that you've responded to. Clearly, plenty of damage around here, but maybe not as severe as other disasters you've responded to.
I think every disaster is different in their own way. In Missouri, our biggest challenge is finding people. A lot of people have been evacuated. And so when we go door to door, there's not anyone there. So we solicit help from even the police department or the sheriff's department or the local emergency manager to try to help locate where these people have moved to, so that we can go and we can find them and make sure that they get registered. Recently, there was a little event, a barbecue, neighborhood barbecue, at the Lewis and Clark Village. And so the local emergency manager found out about it, called us, said, you know, look, there's going to be about 50 people there. And so we jumped on it and went out there in the evening. And was able to register quite a few people, answer a lot of questions that people had. And I think it turned out it was a really good opportunity for us to be able to catch those people that we couldn't catch. And we use every opportunity like that we get.
Debbie Archner is part of the FEMA Disaster Survivor Assistance Team with FEMA. Also with me, Christiana Sanford, who is a public affairs specialist with FEMA. How many, Christiana, how many of these disaster assistance teams do we have on the ground here?
Yeah, so we have about 98 team members spread out across the state. Wow. And like she said, they visited over 500 homes so far. And we're, you know, closing out some counties, moving along. But they are going to be out there knocking on doors until we hopefully reach every single one.
How many do you think there are? How many victims do you think there are out there? Do you have an estimate?
You know, I'm not sure on the estimate. I know we've completed over 1,300 home inspections. And so, I mean, there's quite a few, I mean, thousands of people. And that's, like she said, a lot of them have evacuated. And that's why we really encourage people to reach out to FEMA, call us, stop by a disaster recovery center. And we need to hear from you so we can get you the help you need.
Give me the phone number and website again.
Absolutely. It's disasterassistance.gov, or you can call 1-800-621-3362.
Debbie, anybody stick out for you so far since you've been on the ground here in Missouri? Is there a particular story that you sit around and talk with your disaster assistance colleagues about?
There probably is a lot of them. But one that I remember, we were talking to a lady, and it was her third time flooding.
Oh, my.
And she was just in tears. Yeah. And so we didn't take the time then to tell her about all the FEMA programs. We took the time then just to be a shoulder. And that one kind of sticks out on me here.
Just as important as getting somebody's roof fixed, would you say?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So how do you train for this?
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, what do you need to know? It seems like everything.
Yeah, but I think that if you just love people and are compassionate, I think it automatically comes out, and you know, in the time of need. I don't know that there's any training that you can get, but I think that just if you're compassionate, that's the best thing you can do.
Yeah, it seems to me, Christiana, that you have to be a little bit of a construction manager, and you have to be a little bit of a plumber, and you have to be a little bit of a, you know, government paperwork expert. I mean, this is really a renaissance kind of job.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's why we employ people from all across the country to come in and help when these disasters hit, because we do need those specialties, you know, and it takes a village. And these things, you know, we always say are a marathon, not a sprint. You know, the disaster recovery, it's overwhelming. It's complex. And a lot of people don't understand FEMA until they need to. You know, and so that's why these teams, these DSA teams are great. They get out on the ground, they knock on doors, and they try to break it down as much as possible and get these people help.
Yeah. So what's the paperwork like for this? So you go to the you go to somebody's house and you decide that it needs a new roof or whatever. Is it overwhelming government paperwork, or is it streamlined in a way that gets people the help?
Yeah, it's not. You know, the DSA teams that knock on doors, all they're doing is registering them on disasterassistance.gov, which is about a 20-minute process. And if they did have damage that they need an inspector come out, we have an inspector call them. Right now it's operating on about a 24-hour turnaround, which is great. And then the inspector will come out, look at the property, and then file that paperwork. And these things can take a matter of days to get assistance dollars into bank accounts, which is really great. So it can be a fast process, and that's why we say, you know, the sooner you register, the sooner we can get you that help.
Yeah, and getting people into like a temporary rental place, or getting them into a place that is safe and sanitary, can that happen immediately? You go there, you look at the house, it looks like hell, and you think we need to get these people out. Can it happen right then?
Yeah, I mean, a matter of days. I mean, I've heard quick turnaround, I mean, 2 to 3 days after you register, and we'll pay up to 18 months of temporary rental assistance.
Wow. So, Debbie, what's it like just to move from disaster to disaster? I mean, it seems like, you know, you're probably not. Are you still living in Orlando?
Is that true? I am.
Yeah.
I am.
That you know, you may not be there all the time, right? I mean, you have to have a go bag, right? Next, you get a call and you're out the door. Tell me how it works.
You do. We do keep a go bag packed. Typically, when we get a deployment request, we have to be in the state that they need us in 24 to 48 hours. And then we hit the ground running as soon as we get here. And we do long days. We work long days, and we can get tired. But we've learned to look out for each other, and so that we can look out for the survivors.
I'm just told that FEMA is announcing the opening of a recovery center in Jackson County. This is true?
Yes, it should hopefully be open by tomorrow. So I think they're still kind of building it out. And then we will get that information out everywhere we possibly can.
Yeah. Do you know where you're opening it up?
I do not. I have not been given that address yet.
Yeah. Tell me what a recovery center does. So you walk in and then what?
Yeah. So our disaster recovery centers are going to be popping up in all the affected counties as needed. And they're just a really good place to go in and speak to someone face to face, whether that is getting you registered for FEMA assistance, you can ask questions about the process and the status of your application. And then we also have representatives from the Small Business Administration there. They can talk to you about those low-interest disaster loans that are offered as well. And then we can also just get you in touch with other help that you need. We coordinate with other nonprofit, charitable, faith-based organizations, so we can kind of get you set up with whatever you need.
I'm just looking at part of the news release now. Fort Osage Fire Department, 400 East Monroe Street in Buckner, Missouri, 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. They don't call this up to date for nothing.
There you go.
Do you ever work out of these recovery centers, or you're just out on the street?
No, Debbie? I'm strictly door-to-door.
And so where are you? So when we let you go here in a couple minutes, where are you headed?
I am headed to Holt County. Mound City is where I'll be going.
What do you know about that right now?
I know that there's a lot of people up there that really need our help. So we've already gone door to door one time up there. We're doing a second round right now. And we've gotten a couple of calls from people that need specific help. We're going, making sure we get to them today. So that's our focus today, up in that area.
Mm. Is it typical to revisit neighborhoods or counties as people come back from wherever they were after they evacuated?
Sometimes we do. It depends upon the severity of the damage in the neighborhood and how many people are still there as to whether we feel like that we need to get back. A lot of times it's just neighbor helping neighbor. They'll give us their address and say, go over there and find this person. So we do it. And it really works out.
Christiana, any idea how long you guys will be on the ground in Missouri?
We'll be on the ground as long as it takes. You know, like I said, we work closely with the local emergency managers to get that roadmap of who was affected, where they were affected, and we will go around and knock on doors until we hit everyone.
Yeah. Any idea how much FEMA has spent on disaster relief so far in this part of the country since the floods?
Yeah. So since March, our National Flood Insurance Program has paid over $18 million in flood claims. And then for
Just here
in Missouri.
Wow.
Yes. And then for FEMA assistance, we've approved over 700 households for $3.1 million.
Wow. So what happens when you're done here, Debbie? You go back to Orlando, you repack the go bag, and then...
Watch the Weather Channel.
I'm wondering if I just want to go back and just make sure that I understand what's happening in Kansas. So you guys have been meeting with state officials, Department of Transportation, whatever, trying to get infrastructure fixed. Is that what's happening in Kansas?
Yep, it's a public assistance disaster only. So I mean it's very complex. But those grant dollars go to hazard mitigation as well as those roads, bridges, infrastructure. And we work closely with the locals in the state for those projects.
Yeah. And so my last question was, can folks still seek FEMA help? But you guys are out there aggressively doing that, opening up a center in Jackson County.
Absolutely.
Heading back out on the road to make sure that that people are getting taken care of. Yes.
Yep. Absolutely.
All right. Outstanding. One more time with the website and the 800 number.
Yes. You can go to disasterassistance.gov or call 1-800-621-3362.
Christiana Sanford with FEMA's Public Affairs Office. Thanks for being on Up to Date.
Thank you.
Debbie Artsner, part of FEMA's Disaster Survivor Assistance Team. You're doing good work, my friend. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
On yesterday's program, how the social pressure to quote unquote be a man can impact a boy's health. Hear that and other previous episodes at kcur.org/up-to-date. You can find us on Twitter. We're at @KCURUpToDate. Me, you can find me. I'm @SamZeff. And don't forget to like KCUR on the Facebook. No update tomorrow because of the Robert Mueller testimony. Back on Thursday, though, with recommendations for summer food that keeps you cool and helps you beat the heat. The show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Emily Atkin. I'm Sam Zeff. You're up to date.